Well, hello, folks, and welcome to another episode of the Texas Titans podcast. I am so grateful for you being here. Today's guest is Luke Coffey. Luke is a Dallas-based Texas filmmaker who made his way to Hollywood and then via Baylor Film School. He's a Baylor grad where he received a degree in film and went out to L.A. and did the Hollywood thing for a while, working on shows such as Vegas and several others as both an associate producer. He did some acting and then found his way back to Texas. And his journey back to Texas is one that is, this is one of the most amazing and touching stories that I'm ever going to bring you on the Texas Titans podcast. And here's what I've done special on this. First, I'm breaking this up into two parts. This was a very long, in-depth, a very personal interview with Luke. And so what I've done is the first half, the first interview is just so that you get to know Luke, where he's from, which he grew up in Dallas, Texas. He is, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, a fifth generation Texan. And so you'll learn a bit about that. And you'll learn about how he got into film, what inspired him to pursue it from a very, very young age. And we'll talk about that just so that you get an idea of who he is. But then next week, I'm going to bring you part two of Luke's story that you will not want to miss. It is amazing. It's tragic. But in the midst of the tragedy, there is something always to be celebrated, and you're going to learn about that. So if that's not a dramatic enough tease for you, I don't know what else you need. But also, you're going to find out on next week's episode, part two, about the upcoming film that Luke will be making about this tragic yet beautiful story that is at the that he is at the center of in every way. So with that, I am happy to introduce to you Texas filmmaker, Dallas native, long generational Texan, Luke Coffey. Enjoy this interview with a very, very fun guy. And thanks again for being here on the Texas Titans podcast. I'm so grateful. Thanks. Luke Coffey, how are you, my brother?
I'm doing great. How are you, Mr. Wright?
I am doing well. Well, thank you for taking the time to sit down with me. You know, I mean, film producer, actor, you know, Texas boy made good, as it were. I appreciate you spending this time with me.
It's a privilege to spend time with you, Mr. Wright.
Okay. All right. So enough of that. All right. So let's just get right into it. I want to start out by just finding out a little bit about the early years of Luke Coffey. Where are you from? And then let's take it from there. I want to go from Texas to Hollywood. Go.
Okay. Grew up in Big D, also known as Dallas. Grew up in the Park Cities area. I think early on in my life, I just was really taken by, you know, film and storytelling in general, and just the medium that is film, that encompasses really all art forms as one, and just how powerful it is to go into, you know, it was a bigger time back then where you go to the theaters, which is kind of changing at this point, and which is unfortunate, but where you could go for 2 hours and escape into like a story and be transported to this story. And I was really just inspired early on about just how amazing it is and thinking technically, how did they do that? And just all the aspects of, I know that's not real and this isn't real, but how do they do that? And, you know, so it just caught, you know, my interest. I remember being a little kid and just being intrigued. We had a family ranch down in Bosque County in Clifton, Texas, out near Hillsboro, Meridian area. And my grandmother got us an old VHS camera for my dad to originally capture, you know, the old family memories. And I started just coming up with just like spoofs of different movies I'd seen and casting my siblings and my cousins and, you know, trying to figure out how this storytelling process through film is done. And so it was just kind of trial by fire or whatever. And had two old VCRs that I do tape to tape, like editing. I figured out how to do that. And and trying to put some music to it. And early on, it was humming the chorus of different, you know, soundtracks that I knew of. For instance, like our first spoof was Indiana Jones and the Last Cowpatty, and I think my prepubescent voice was humming the dun da 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 da, and that's the end and beginning of the whole film. But we had some cool shots. I remember putting the camera on the four wheeler, the family four wheeler, and then my brother, you know, running and jumping onto a rope that was randomly just, you know, connected to the back of it and hanging on. And but anyway, so I, you know, we did that over holidays. I mean, we spent our weekends down at that ranch, and it was just really fun to kind of that was what we did. And luckily my cousins and siblings, you know, liked the idea of it. And I guess soon after that, I got in through my first grade talent show. I did a Lionel Richie Dancing on a Ceiling lip sync, and it was with my mom addressed me, and you know, it was a Miami Vice Don Johnson attire, which yes. Doesn't go with the Lionel Richie, you know, attire really. But she choreographed it for me, and it was a big hit for the Miss Connors first grade class at Hyde Park Prez. So later that summer, you know, I was about to turn seven, and there was a casting at Irving Mall for a show called Putting on Hits.
I remember that show. I remember it.
An old Dick Clark show. Yeah. It was like, you know, America's Got Talent or one of those shows, Star Search, but for lip syncing. And I think because I was young and a cute kid back then, and was kind of unapologetically unashamed to jump on stage, I made it to the finals and got on that show. So that was my first experience with the acting side. And
right.
So, you know, then sports took over, and but in the back of my head, I actually did it. On the summers, I was in this sing-along TV show, and we did like 50s sing-alongs for local TV, and very cheesy show, but it ran on Saturday mornings, and kids loved that. They loved it.
Now, did your siblings ever do anything, or was it just you? Were you the only entertainer in the family?
It was mainly me, and they always joked that I was the diva growing up. And
I think my family would say the same thing about me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was the firstborn, and I think I probably, like, killed it for all of them, unfortunately. But I love them a lot, and they've supported me. But anyway, so then I guess, you know, Jason sports took over, and you know, baseball and football, and then I found football, and I that's all I cared about for years. But I still did the school plays, and then in high school it wasn't too cool to be a thespian.
Right.
So I really didn't have time with track and football until my senior year. I did senior play and senior talent show, but they did have a TV program for my junior and senior year at Highland Park High School, and we had our own TV show called School Zone, and it was the first, you know, it was on TV. We get to produce it was a magazine style show where we produced a 10-minute segment about different stuff that was going on in the school district, or a different sport, or a different highlight of a different person. And we edited it, shot it, and sometimes was the on-air talent reporter. And so that was, I thoroughly enjoyed that, and I really enjoyed the editing side and saw the value of the post-production and the storytelling in that. So then I ended up going to two different schools, started at Wheaton College, went to play football originally, but took all the films classes they had in the first year and knew I wanted to learn more. Plus, I wasn't a super fan of Wheaton and the weather, and just it was a very super conservative environment. So ended up transferring to Baylor, and they had a great film program and had Sony had just started backing the program and had high definition cameras, and that was back when, you know, early 2000 when HD was brand new and it was the hot, you know, everything switched to 16:9, and you know, this was this new takeoff, and everybody was moving away from film, and so it was a cool time to learn about, you know, where the industry was going, and Sony literally gave us the hot off the press stuff, models of cameras and editing equipment. So, during that time, I don't remember going to school other than my film projects. I'm pretty sure I did, because I did get a film degree from Baylor University, but I spent a lot of time at the telecommunications school, where I got a degree in film. And
which, by the way, I think you're the only person that I know that has a film degree, period. I didn't even know that was a thing at Baylor. And I think it's really cool because, you know, I know that I would not have had the guts to, well, prime example, I was a journalism major in undergrad, and there was broadcast journalism, but even though, as much as I would love to have been a news writer and then been an anchor, I wouldn't do it because I always had this mindset of, well, everyone wants to be on TV, so there's no way I'm ever going to be on TV, and so I wouldn't pursue it. And so it says something about you and your makeup, or something in your background, some encouragement you had, that you were willing to, you're going to go off to college, but pursue something, a cool career, a passion career. Mm-hmm. I think I admire that, you know, because there's not many people that do that. I mean, most kids, they go off to school and you ask them, so what's your major? I don't know. Or it's something pretty basic, standard. But you decide, even when you went off to Wheaton, you still had the passion for film. Where did that come from? Where did you get the freedom, the courage to go, I'm not going to be an accountant. I want to make movies. I want to figure out how to do that. Where do you think that came from?
Yeah, I mean, I think early on I had, I remember my grandmother was my super fan growing up, and I was her firstborn grandson out of, you know, what ended up being 13 grandchildren on my mother's side. And she was just loved that I was quirky and weird and, you know, did all the kind of filmmaking and acting stuff. She just was a big proponent of who I was and loving me in that. And then my mother was right there, is very much, you know, cut from the same cloth. So she encouraged her and was, you know, somewhat of a stage mom. She didn't over push me or anything. But I think as I grew up, I saw my dad be very successful as, you know, he originally, I think, wanted to do ministry, and he met my mother, and because it was a safer path, got into the real estate game, and he was marrying a judge's daughter from Highland Park, and the pressure that comes with that, and being a provider as a man, and so he sidelined maybe his passion to, you know, for love, and then I saw him be very successful in real estate, and start his own commercial company, and then the 80s market crashed. I remember writing I still have it. It's pretty funny. I was writing my life story when I was a little kid, but it was like, because it was so drastic of a change in a two-year period. I think I went to 4 elementary schools in a year and a half, or 4 or 5, but we were living on, you know, in this mansion, you know, in Highland Park, and multi-million-dollar house, and then the market crashed, and, you know, like many other people, he had to file bankruptcy, and his company went to kaput, but we wanted to hang on to our family ranch that we loved so much, and thought that everything would turn around, and so we ended up moving to Clifton, Texas, for a year of my life, which was a very small. I was out in the middle of nowhere in the country and hunting armadillos after school, and continued to make films and stuff like that, and I remember I was. You know, my big claim to fame, I went back into college and somebody recognized me. Luke Coffey, aren't you? You were the first SOB that had Nintendo, you know? So, but we lasted just a year there, and I think my parents got bored, and they could only watch so many movies and drink so many pitchers of margaritas every night before they got bored. And just they picked me up one day and headed back to Dallas. But I think, at some point, my dad just saw – you know, like the waves of time, just this, you know, a lot of wealth come and go. And I think he kind of lost fulfillment from that pursuit of what he, you know, he had already seen success and saw that, you know, how quickly, you know, this wealth and, you know, possessions can just disappear. And so, you know, he started doing more ministry. He was always doing it on the side and contributing to ministries. And I think over, you know, the next period, it was really once I went off to college, I remember getting a call that he was going to quit. He was in, you know, he did all aspects of real estate for those last, I guess, the following 8 to 10 years. But he just said, Luke, I feel called to go pursue ministry. And so I think just, you know, that was, you know, I saw him wrestle with unfulfillment, you know, from this other pursuit. And I knew his passion was doing this other thing. So I think that showed me, and also growing up in an environment where money doesn't equal happiness. And, you know, there were, I was friends with very wealthy people that not necessarily were had the happiest family or, you know, childhood or whatever. So I think that gave me the confidence on top of, you know, being encouraged as a kid to pursue my, you know, my desires or my giftings or whatever that I felt was inside of me. And I think it is a gift. If most kids maybe haven't discovered it when they're a child, but like it was in me. And so that, you know, I guess, you know, at the end of college, I had dated a wonderful lady or wonderful woman, gal. And I think she had a different future plan than I did. And it was in Oklahoma and starting a family very soon after college. And I knew that if I never went to LA and pursued that, then I would get in a safe place and be scared to ever venture out.
Which that right there takes a lot of courage. I mean, have you seen the movie Whiplash?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. I just introduced Jimlin to that night before last.
Yeah.
And literally, you know, the main character, he sits the girl down that he's dating and says, I'm going to have to break up with you because here's what's about to happen. I want to be the best drummer ever. I want to pursue this and you're going to get in the way of that. First, you're going to resent me for wanting to be the best. Then I'm going to resent you for wanting some of my time. It's just not going to work. And so, boom. And I'm like sitting there watching that going, wow, you know, what courage. And that's why I kind of wanted to dig into this because, yeah. You know, because there's been times in my life where I didn't do that. I did the safe thing. You know, you're supposed to, you know, go to college, graduate, get the job, have the 2.1 children, blah, blah, blah. And you just follow this kind of, you know, unspoken path that you do. But yet it sounds to me like you had a lot of wisdom at a young age. And in fact, what probably was one of the biggest catastrophes that as a family that you guys went through, it kind of seems like it solidified that, man, I've sat here, I've had a front row seat to watching go up, down, not following your passion. So it almost made it like gave you even more boldness, it sounds like, to do that.
Yeah, and I think I was prepared for adversity at an early age and seeing life change at a whim, and which it can do. And just it also showed me that there's an adventure in the unknown and the experiences I would have, like if I had never lived at my ranch as a kid, I would have never gotten to go. Every day I went with my black lab and hunted armadillos, and it was like, you know, kids, I loved it. It was, you know, a Texas kid's dream, you know. But it was just such a different experience than being in Highland Park and that whole lifestyle of that. So, but yeah, I think part of it too was knowing I had this inside of me. I had this wonderful girl that was, you know, I looked at as, you know, all through college, that she will be this perfect wife. But our desires didn't completely line up. And she thought LA was a phase. And I honestly thought like life with her would be like, I would almost, she'd come from a great oil, you know, big oil family, a great family, but also like I would have gotten in the oil business most likely. And I had no desire to do that. And I also had it was probably a part of me, a pride thing of like, I don't want to marry into this job and career and wealth. And I want to go forge my own path. And like that, is a more adventurous path. And yeah, there's more risk, but I think I'll 20 years from now we'll be like, still have this itch and like, why didn't I do that? And possible regret. And like you said, possible resentment. So, and you know, I'll get into this later, but I do feel like, you know, our journeys are, we have, you know, there's that there is a plan and a story behind our journeys that, and I've seen this through, like, I broke it off with her, and her uncle was a producer in LA and my only connection to Hollywood. And so I asked her for his number. He hired me at Warner Brothers at a show called Everwood. And, you know, within 3 days of getting the call, I was, you know, working on the lot, you know, working on the Warner Brothers lot for, you know, I was actually Chris Pratt's first TV show. And I was just kind of thrown into the fire in it, but it was just, it was exactly what I wanted to be at. And I think I would have, you know, I would have regretted never going out there. And I'd never been to LA, and it was, you know, really the next 5 to 6 years was, you know, 80 to 100-hour weeks, and I was like, that's consumed my life. But I learned so very much, even in the first 6 months, more than I learned in film school. And it was just this trial by fire, and just, you know, and I will say, like, I sat down on the first day with, you know, my ex's uncle, and he said, Luke, the best advice I can give you, especially in this industry, is, and you hear this from different people, but fake it till you make it. And he was like, I still don't know what the hell I'm doing, he told me, you know. And I was like, and he was the executive producer of this TV wow. show. So it's just like, he's like, figure it out. If you don't know how to, ask someone, but just be confident that you can figure it out. And that's, there's a lot of truth in that. And cause they had me go, I remember one of the first couple days I was spotting for dirt, and I had no idea what that was, but they sent me to a place called Laser Pacific.
Yeah, what is spotting Cahuenga. For dirt?
Yeah, I had no idea. And I was like, all right, I knew where I was supposed to go. So I went there, and I got to the post-production house, and I was like, so I'm supposed to be spotting for dirt. And I asked one of the folks there, I was like, so what exactly is that? And so it basically, it was you have to go by frame, the final episode. And literally, like, there's a flip book of every frame, and you literally, like, make a little mark where there is dirt on the film or hair or whatever that gets on the film.
Okay.
And so now they don't even shoot on film anymore, but it later got to where they could digitally remove that. But I had to go toggle through every frame of that 43-minute episode of, you know, that hour-long TV show and look for dirt, you know, and which was, you know, but it was just crazy. And then Loop Group, which you would love. Like, I was supposed to oversee the Loop Group, which you don't think about this in films and TV shows. There's, you know, on set, there's only the main actors are talking, right? So then it's made up of a very tight-knit group of Hollywood. It's usually Hollywood wives, or it's hard to get in because you're a SAG actor, but they go and watch the cut episode, and there's usually 7 to 10 of these people that have and a leader, and they go and watch the TV show. And they are watching, you know, they may run through it once to practice, but say it's a pool scene, and a lot of these girls can do, like, kids' voices and stuff like that, but they're watching what these extras are saying and then putting words in their mouth and background, and they're having full conversations and stuff like that. And it's just, and they get, you know, they're getting paid, like, every time that TV show, they're getting SAG residuals for every time that airs, and they're, like, you can barely hear, you know. Wow. I remember sitting there the first time, and I was kind of just amazed by the whole thing. And they're, you know, these two girls were acting like they were these teenagers. Like, do you see Luke over there? He's so cute. You know, it's like, oh my God, he's so hot. You know, and so that's in the back of the scene on Everwood. You know, you'd have to turn it way up. Right. But, you know, and then this guy brings it. If it's a doctor scene, he'll be like, paging Dr. Rosen. You know, yes. And you know, so they'll have all these. You know, they'll have all this. Language for being in a doctor's office that they'll say, and they'll literally just be in a audio studio watching it on TV and just kind of take turns and adding background voices to the extras. So it was just kind of just a cool, you know, you know, and they're also still doing kind of live sound effects at a sound stage at that point, which was really cool to watch. It was just everything I like was excited to. It was just kind of this amazement of, wow, that's how they do it, you know. Yeah. And I didn't even know they did that, and just and they kind of threw me, like I was overseeing this stuff, and I was like, I'm just a kid from, you know, coming out from Waco, Texas, you know. But it was just, it was kind of an energizing. I loved the experience, but it was just long hours though, and I was, but I was very much, I felt like I was getting to do what I always wanted to do.
Well, and that's the cool. Well, first of all, I think you may just have leapt to the top of all my podcast guests, because anytime you throw in a Fletch reference, I mean, you just endeared yourself to me forever. And but secondly. And that's one of the things, you know, I talk about on the podcast a lot is entrepreneurship, following your passion, whatever that, whether it's smoking barbecue or you know, if you decide you want to design brooms, I don't care. Right. It's amazing what a difference life can be whenever you're actually following your passion. And yeah, you were working the 100-hour days and weeks or whatever, and it just, but yet you are enjoying it and you're getting to see behind the scenes. But one of the things I want to ask you about is. Because it is, I mean, to most people listening, everything you just talked is like you might as well have said you went to Mars and described it. Because we know the movie industry, but it's like this whole forbidden city. It's this whole world that we all kind of gawk at, but nobody really knows behind the scenes. And you walk up, you're in L.A. for the first time, so all of a sudden you go to this place that has great weather. It's got a lot of pretty people. I mean, just L.A. just kind of takes you in the first time you're there anyway. And you get to actually go on a lot, you know, and a movie set or a movie or a film lot, whatever, studio lot, whatever the actual term is. What do you feel? Are you like a little kid at Disney World for the first time? I mean, kind of describe the feelings that you have whenever you're, when you go, oh my gosh, did you pinch yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of, it felt like kind of another dimension. You know, I'd gone from, you know, the very comfortable of, you know, being in Waco and Dallas to like this unknown world. And it was, I remember, you know, honestly going to the first couple weekends, just going to Venice Beach and because of Fletch and, you know, it just going by myself and just laughing my ass off of just the bizarre, you know, uniqueness of these people. And, you know, it was another dimension.
Yeah.
And I loved
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know, it was, like it really energized me. And then, yeah, getting to go to the lot, and I, like, you know, I remember the first day I interviewed, and he didn't guarantee me the job, and I was just like, I'll figure it out. I was couch surfing with a buddy, and I remember going to the interview, and it was like right across from Friends, and Friends was my favorite show at that point, and I was just like, this is unbelievable, you know?
Yeah.
And so just getting to, you know, and it was, they actually shot the TV show in Utah, so it was all the writers. It was the writers and the producers, and then the editors, and just, you know, it was just the characters were just so different from any, you know. And I think that's getting into entrepreneurship in general and what the adventure of taking risks in life. You put yourself in uncomfortable positions where you also get to potentially meet people that you would have never met if you hadn't chosen to take that risk and just chosen a different uncomfortable path
yep.
than what your dad did. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's delight in that of looking at this life as this is a joyful adventure, even in, you know, I have just the best, craziest stories from my time in LA. And I feel like I got all of it, you know, the good, bad, and the ugly. And, like, I have a funny L.A., you know, story experience from my, you know, 6+ years out there. So, I don't want to get into all the details of it, but it was, like, it was, you know, I'll share this. I was the only straight guy on this TV show. I found out, you know, the third day that I was, like, out of all the males, I was the only straight guy. So that was, you know, that was experience. But it also, like, I got to... You know, even though it was uncomfortable at different points, I got to get to love people that were different than people I would have, you know, encountered, you know, in different places just in Texas, you know, just because it was, you know, it was just everybody was loving what they were doing for the most part. And And it was this getting behind. They all loved story, and they got why I loved it. You know, yeah. So it was such a it was. So we all had that in common, and I was this, you know, Texan, you know, that wore Wranglers and Red Wings, you know, to Warner Brothers every day, and you know, and it was like, I was kind of fine with that. That's who, you know, they view me as or whatever, and so it was, you know, and then I did have a casting director who got me, like, encouraged me to go, you know, he told me I was going to be his midlife crisis project to bring me to the dark side. And I told him, well, that's not happening. But he's like, well, you're really on the wrong side of the camera. You need to be pursuing acting. And I was like, I didn't come out here as one of those fools to do that. And then he had me audition for the show called The OC. And I ended up, you know, making it to the last kind of studio round where they were looking at three of us. And I believe three or four of us. And I had never done a cold read. I didn't know what that was, but it was just like this. It was just kind of a, all right, whatever, I'm out here kind of experience. And then I, you know, kind of got bored with the post-production side, but I saw the, you know, I wanted to be an editor, and then kind of saw these guys that were editors and realized my personality is not of that type, which is you go into a dark room and shut the door and back in the day do a lot of coke and cut, you know, cut film all day. But now it's just, you know, you go in there and are in a dark room on a computer. And they were just kind of there. They weren't, most of them weren't outgoing type people. And I'm a people person and desire to, be around people. Everybody encouraged me to figure out what you really want to do and be vocal about within the industry. Cause there's so many different, you know, it's a specialized, there's so many specialized, roles within filmmaking in general.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's very different experiences with each one of those, and that's what's cool about filmmaking is, you know, you have, they're all these people that come together as like spokes on a wheel, cogs in a machine, and then they produce this great, you know, or horrible,
yeah,
piece of art, you know. So
but they're all getting to do what they love. That's the right thing. Whenever you look at the credits of a movie, mm-hmm, and you look first of all at all of the different roles that exist just to put that thing together,
right,
it's kind of mind-blowing. And one of the things that kind of fascinates me about your story the most is all the way back from whenever you were a little kid on the ranch and forward, is it seems like you always had kind of a behind-the-camera type of desire, and it wasn't until the guy told you needed to be in front of the camera and the OC. Did you still, even though producing the product was kind of your passion, and had you ever thought, well, it would be cool kind of to be on the other side of the camera should that present itself? I mean, or was it always just, I want to be a producer, I want to be a director, I want to create? I mean,
I thought, and even looking back, everyone encouraged me to, you know, learn as much about every role as you could. And, yeah, I think going out there, I was like, you know, if I had the opportunity, you know, and was – how it happened, like, was actively pursued to consider pursuing that. Like, I don't know if I would have necessarily taken that risk if I didn't have somebody prodding me to audition or something like, yeah, that, because it's such, you know, it's just, you hear that every day 3,000 different people getting off the boat that were the homecoming king or queen or best looking person in their small town Texas, you know, and we're told to go be, they look like a movie star.
Right.
But I think as I went on, I saw the business side of it. It's like, it's all about who you know and connections. And, you know, if you know a casting director, you could get in without having an agent. And, you know, and I didn't even have an agent early on, and was a big casting director was wanting me to audition. So it's just, I saw that more of the business side and less of the risk, you know, of just being one of those, you know, there is. I saw that if you don't have any connections, you're most likely gonna fall on your face, and yeah, you know. But over the years, you know, I was like, I'm gonna take some classes just for fun, and did The Groundlings, which I loved, and got in. There was a Texas director that cast me in some little independent films as a cowboy, and I was like, yeah, I'd like to play. I mean, if I could do some cowboy roles here and there, that'd be fun, you know. I've always wanted to be a cowboy, you know. So anyway, so I saw that. Yeah, I saw that aspect of it, and I've always liked performing. I mean, but I also saw that, you know, from, you know, the part of being, you know, not that I'm a control person at all, but just being the creative behind telling a story, I got more fulfillment from like seeing it all being put together rather than just one little piece of it, right?
Right.
So, and that, you know, if down the road, if I was a producer, I could, you know, if there's a role, I could put myself in it.
Right. Whatever, yeah, because describe to, and most people don't even know probably, I mean, describe what a producer does. I mean, because I know there's all different aspects of producing, just throwing money in or putting the money in and having creative control. Tell the audience what a producer actually does.
So there's a producer, you know, there's kind of, as far as like the top executive producers, there's usually a creative producer who either is, you know, came up with the script or concept or story, and then they're in charge of kind of the creative aspects of it, and you know, and then they'll bring on, there's different roles of each producer can be given, and they can be contributing different aspects of it, but you know, a lot of times there's an executive producer that is part of this, if it's in the studio world, that is connected to the studio, and he's in charge of making sure that all the money is allocated properly, and that it, everyone doesn't go over budget, and the creative person doesn't have to worry about that. There's usually a line producer that's in, it's in the trenches with the actual budget and like hiring and firing and all that and all aspects of that, and you know, there's another producer sometimes that's just dealing with the talent and those talent deals and dealing with agents. That, you know, there's different roles, and sometimes it's, you know, an up and coming producer that's finally got an associate producer credit that's supporting some of these producers. So right. It's just, there's, you know, you'll see how many, you know, I think on language we had like 7 or 8 of us that were producers, and we all kind of contributed different things. And so it's kind of, you know, it's, and it is kind of a fraternal type experience where, you know, there's, you start as a PA, a production assistant. I was a post-production assistant, and you got, everyone has to, unless they're just, their daddy's a big executive producer at one of the studios or whatever, but you have to start kind of in the trenches and mm-hmm. work your way up, and regardless, and some may not have to do it as long as others, but I saw like the post-production, you know, angle was the quickest, aspect was the quickest way to get to producer, especially in the studio system, less years, and you know, it was, I don't know, I went on to a show called Las Vegas, which was a great experience. Josh Duhamel, it was kind of his first breakout role. James Caan, Vanessa Marcel, Nikki Cox. It was shot in Culver City, and they actually built, you know, a working casino in a big warehouse space. And we had, which was cool because, like I said, the other show Everwood was shot in Utah. So I was just looking at dailies that they would, you know, overnight. To us, you know, so I wasn't ever, other than a wrap party in each season, able to be part of like the cast and that mm-hmm. that side of the experience. But what was cool is the Las Vegas, I was down on set, you know, a lot of days, you know, we'd go down there and get to watch and see how a set's run, and these are, you know, there could be as many as, you know, 100 plus extras, and, you know, in the casino set, and then 60 crew members. So it's just like, it's a big machine.
Right.
And, you know, there's 3 episodes typically going on at one time in regards to the post, you know, post-production. They're all at different phases along the way. You know, we're prepping one for air, while one is just starting post-production, one's in the middle of it, you know, and so there's just... And so I learned that whole side of the business, which I think as now as a director, both the acting pursuit and the post pursuit, looking at how it all comes together, I can kind of work backwards and see like the end result and say, okay, that's what I want. So how do we get there? Whereas some directors have never edited and don't have the post production experience. Therefore, they're just shooting constantly, and to me that can be a waste of time. And you know, if you see the final thing, and there's different philosophies in all this, but It preps you to learn as much as you can, just like I think it would with different other industries, but just learning all aspects so you can also relate to these people that now are working for you or as part of your team, working with you on these different projects.
And so now you've made it out there, you've done some assistant work, you know, you're eyeing towards producing. What is the first time that you actually get to work on a project where you've got some creative control, where this is your fingerprint's going to be on the product?
Well, you know, I think it was, well, I mean, as I got up there, I was a post-production coordinator and supervisor, and it was like, you know, just seeing our name on, you know, on the credits was pretty cool. I remember that, yeah. You know, as, you know, and it basically as I was one step away from producing on this TV show, and that's when I kind of decided to exit and kind of had the scratch to itch for acting. But I think like that, I did feel like I was very much, I mean, we were part of it, and we're part of the studio system, though. It was just like, it was a little part of it, you know, just, yeah. There's so many, I saw as an independent producer that just so many, you know, quote unquote suits had at the studio and network level were, you know, basically making sure, you know, the studio approved of this particular episode in the network, then they'd go to the network and that they would approve it, and it could just get, that vision could get chopped up a little bit. And I just saw like even the creator of the show, you know, lose some control in it. And so I, you know, creatively, that was like, you know, I was like, damn, I mean, this guy has come up with a concept, written the script, is directing most of these episodes, and it's like changing so much once we get to these levels, but just kind of a corporate entertainment game. And I think like that's what prodded me to, like, you know, one, just I want to go after this acting thing for a while and then just start thinking about producing my own, you know, projects and raising equity, you know, potentially where I could have more creative control over the end product,
right?
Which, you know, that's, I think that was more of me getting out of the studio world. Looking back, it was a great experience because you had 2 or 3 months off of hiatus if you knew the show was coming back, and you could go do your own projects or go travel or whatever. It was, you know, even you were working these 90-100-hour weeks. But it was great just talking back about, like, just having the experience of having other people around me, even though we had a great group of people from the South that all were kind of going after their entertainment dreams, different capacity of that. And so we all worked hard and played harder probably. But it was like, we at least had this great group of friends, which LA can be a lonely place if you don't find that group. And we all related to each other being, you know, from the South and having those same values. But so I got a role soon after I quit. Like, they gave me a role, Jimmy or Billy, the bellboy. I was supposed to have a crush on one of the lead actors. But I remember that day, like, I remember the first day, it was me and Dean Cain and I were the guest stars of this episode. And I had a trailer, and I was like, what? And I had an insecurity that they all see me as the post coordinator, post supervisor guy, you know?
Yeah.
And the whole crew and stuff. And I remember, like, I, like, brought some, like, vodka, and I was, like, doing shots to, like, calm my nerves. And then they had this long shot that was all through it was this kind of complicated shot with a Roman camera through the casino, and then they'd end up with me, and I was going to have a flowers in my hand and supposed to be kind of awestruck by the beauty of one of the leads, Nikki Cox, and I was like, I was a deer in the headlights, I think, on my first couple takes, and the creator of the show was like, Luke, relax, you know, and like yelled it in front of everybody, and everybody started laughing, you know, and I remember Dumal was like, hey, you know, Luke, I remember how nervous I was on, you know, this is my first big, you know, SAG TV show or whatever. So it was just like a cool experience and kind of gave me some confidence to, like, okay, I did that. And, you know, so anyway, that kind of prodded me to continue on that route. And so anyway, it was just such a great experience out there. And it really gave me confidence, I think, coming back to a smaller market. And, you know, and you did, like, coming back to Dallas or Austin. And I went out to, you know, this is another part of my journey, but I went to South Africa and did a travel show for the World Cup and just traveled around and produced that and, like, approached Cape Town Tourism and the Tourism Board of South Africa, and they just like rolled out the red carpet because I was, you know, had a Texas accent, was an American producer.
Yeah.
And we got this, you know, the top supermodel actress over there to be the host. And it was just a cool journey, but it was just kind of being fearless, you mm-hmm. know, and but because I've already had all these experiences, and I have crazy stories of when I emceed events while I was pursuing acting, and you know, I was working for this company called Host Helpers. I think I shared a little about that. Uh-huh. Just, you know, showing up at random houses and just, you know, serving people. It was a very humbling job, but I was like, also, I was like, this is, I mean, I'm choosing to do this, you know?
Yeah.
And it was kind of like the thrill of it. I think I had shared that Eric Estrada, who was one of my, you know,
here. Poncherello.
Poncherello.
Heck yeah.
I was asked to sing happy birthday to him for his 60th birthday and carry out a cake. And, I said, I'm not a singer, but they didn't care. So I carried out the cake. And it had a picture of Poncherello in his
yes.
Chip's outfit, and I, you know, tone deaf Luke saying happy birthday to him, and it was just like, this is just so bizarre, but it was also just like, I don't think I'd change anything, you know, it was just so, but just with just entrepreneurs, if bringing back to that, it's like, if you look at the journey as part of, you know, it's not the destination, it's the journey.
Absolutely.
And it's like, that's part of the experience of life and the adventure of it, and yeah, the failure or whatever, the uncomfortableness, the growing pangs are all like, that's a part of the gift of going after like something that's not comfortable and
right.
getting outside of your comfort zone. And that's where there's growth, as I think, as a human. And there's also, I think we as entrepreneurs need to have people skills, be able to relate to people, and you know, those uncomfortable moments, like I now relate to service industry people, and you know, and I want to treat those people like the people I valued that treated me well
right.
when I was serving them. You know, I remember I was carrying in, I mean, one of the nicest families was, I did this Jewish I did Yom Kippur, like, and had to bring in, you know, some different, it was Yom Kippur or Hanukkah or whatever, but I carried in like a menorah or something, and they wanted me to sing the Hebrew songs. You know, it's just, I just had like amazing experiences, and there was Hasidic Jews, and I'm like, I decided not to come home for Christmas, I believe, and was, you know, spending my Christmas with a Hasidic Jew family celebrating Hanukkah. But it's just like, you can't, you know, those stories are just like, that's, you know, you just, if you celebrate that journey, and even looking back and you see like what, you know, as if you can have the perspective of like each one of those steps, those zigzags are going to lead you to, you know, your goal, one way or another.
Right.
Whether it's you gave it your shot and you fell on your face. That's not failure to me. If you decided, you know what, I went after it. At least you went after it. Right.
Right. Yeah.
So many people like live in fear and are scared to fail, and failure is not pursuing your passion to me. And,
right.
You know, so it's I think there is so much growth and beauty in the journey itself, and looking back, it's part of your story, of your entrepreneurial story, and it's going to make you appreciate the end goal, or you know 20 years back you'll say, at least I went after it. If you decide, hey, this isn't for me, but I tried it, you know?
Amen to all that. And that's what I mean I could not agree more, and more people, and that's why you're holding that microphone. You know, it's like, I'm not going to wait any longer. I love learning from people and hearing cool stories. I'm going to start a podcast, and I'm going to do this. And yep. Now let's go into some specific projects, some of my favorites that you've both been behind and in front of the camera on. Old Man Football and The Language of a Broken Heart, which you referred to earlier as language. So whenever you hear Luke talk about language, he's talking about his movie, Language of a Broken Heart. And so which one of those projects came first? Language?
Came first. Language of a Broken Heart came first. And it was, yeah, I had finished my project in South Africa, and was like literally semi-deported from South Africa, and came back and was going to go back, and had gotten an agent over there too, which was like, that's a whole nother experience. I had you know, I got a talent agent in South Africa, and I was one of two people that had, you know, American accent. So, and I got cast. This was like one of the coolest projects I've ever been part of. But Ridley Scott's son, Jake Scott, cast me in a Philips Magnavox spot, and he was looking like my agent called me, and he's like, "You won't believe this." She was like, "They're looking for an Alabama hunter," and I was like, "No way." You know, and I was like, if I don't get this, so I go in and, you know, and this is after we kind of were editing the show, and I got this agent, you know, I didn't have a work visa when I got over there, so that was a whole thing. I mean, this is still a third world country, you know, so it was like I was taking I didn't have a car at that point, so I was taking these mega buses, which are like crappy vans, and I was the only white gentleman in these, and they'd you know, just drop me off, and it was before we had iPhones, and I, you know, had a printout of a Google map where a location of this casting was. But anyway, I went in, and it's Ridley Scott's son, who was a couple years older than me, and I like read for him. He goes, "Where are you from, man?" I was like, "Texas." He goes, "What the hell are you doing over here?" You know, and I was like, "Man, it's a long story." But and he was like, "Well, we're changing this from Alabama to East Texas." So they changed the whole set. They addressed it like it was East Texas, and it was out in 3 hours from Cape Town in the bush. And they like had me. They flew in my uncle and I were supposed to be hunters, East Texas hunters now, right? Wow. And so my uncle was from. They flew in and cast from London. And they paid me 2 extra days to help him teach him how to speak Texan.
Teach him how to speak Texan.
Yeah, and which was experience. You know, he couldn't say. One of the lines was, "It's a unicorn," and it's a unicorn. He couldn't say corn. I was like, "Corn, man, corn, kern, unicorn." Like, no, you know. So anyway, it was just like a craziest thing. And this was like a $150,000 commercial spot, like. 3 or 4 days, dressed as, like, they were asking me what would a hunter look like, you know, the wardrobe stylist. And I was like, none of this stuff really looks like it. You know? So it was just, like, such a cool, weird, you know, out-of-body kind of experience where I went all the way to South Africa to play a Texas hunter.
Wow.
You know, and just kind of the, but just, you know, if I wasn't over there and taking a risk of, you know, I moved over there on a whim, knew no one. And, you know, went after this travel show, had a, you know, actually got to date Tanit Phoenix, who's this beautiful South African that, you know, way better looking than out of my league. But, you know, while we were shooting this show, and it was just like, just a fun, amazing, I got to see South Africa, like, by producing this travel show and really got everything covered other than, you know, raise some equity for the, you know, our film crew. And then, you know, 3 weeks after finishing, I'm like cast as a, you know, as a Texas hunter.
Wow.
So just like the experience of that, and just, I mean, it was just, you know, I think also, I guess acting and going on auditions like helps take the fear out of, you know, or take the fear out of things and just, you know, that's, it's a very uncomfortable kind of experience because most, you know, they've seen 100 people and me being on the other side as a producer, like I try to be as pleasant and nice to people that come in, but when you've seen 100 people all day long, it gets old, and you're like, right. "Hey, how you doing?" And most of them aren't even paying attention,
right?
And so it's just, but you know, and just even looking back at emceeing these events, like prepared me for directing, and it was like just directing and emceeing events in Malibu. My biggest event was 10,000 people, and got to introduce the Eagles, and it was just like just because of like choosing this different path. It was so rewarding, and just even, I would say more rewarding was the journey, you know, and just the experience of all those out-of-body moments and that I would have never had if I had just done, you know, chosen the easier path, you know.
Yeah.
And where all my connections were back in Dallas. And
well, okay, so now you've conquered South African tourism. You're an East Texas hunter. And so now somehow Juddy Tall comes into your life, which, by the way, his name should be Juddy Tall. How tall is that dude?
He's like 6'4", and I think he's maybe 86 pounds.
I'm serious. The dude looks like he's 6'8", and maybe
he eats like a squirrel. He only eats nuts and works out, you know, harder than I've ever worked out in my life. But he, I had met a guy that has been my mentor in my life, Rocky Powell, through him hearing about my kind of.
Who's a director and producer?
Who's been one of the historically top Texas directors over the last 30 years here, you know, and as a commercial director. And he had gotten a promo for a film that I'll talk about later, that my passion project, and saw a promo and reached out to me. And my mother, this is just how connections work. And I think that's. If we all look for the connections, and I'm going to bring the spiritual card in here, the people that, you know, God puts in your path could very well be, you know, someone that leads you to that opportunity that you've been looking for, or that, you know, investor, or, you know, just even that encourager that, you know, I think we all need encouragers and someone in our corner, especially if we're doing something that is out of the box. And I think Rocky, I remember coming back to Texas, and he had heard about my project, but it was put on hold. And I was, you know, this is right before I moved to South Africa, and I was like, man, I'd love you to be involved. He was interested in being part of it, but I'm moving to South Africa in 2 weeks. And he was like, well, we have, you know, you remind me of my, you know, my best friend's son, Juddy Tald. He's a writer, actor, and producer, and we're doing this other film. I said, man, I'd love to be a part of it. You know, just let me know. I'm going to go over to South Africa for a while, though. And it was just such a great, I will just say that adventure was just such a great time in my life where I just, you take a plunge. I think sometimes we just need to take a plunge if we're in an uncomfortable place in our lives. And it's good to just like you take that cold shower in the morning that wakes you up, you know, and putting yourself in an uncomfortable position. If you're in a slump, you know, in a business you don't like, go look for something else and just take a risk and go for it, or go start that company or whatever. I mean, that's, if you have something itching at you and you're holding back, I mean, that was just such a great thing. Or take a sabbatical, and if you can, and relax and, you know, travel or whatever. I think there's just, it reminds you that how big this life is. And all, you know, all these, what potential journey we can have. I mean, it's just such an amazing adventure. Life is a gift, you know, with good, bad, and the ugly. It is a gift. So anyway, I got kind of deported. I tried to do a road trip to Namibia, and they gave my two buddies 3 more months, and they gave me 5 days to get the heck out of Dodge, or I was going to be like not ever allowed into South Africa again. So I on Christmas Day, I celebrated at a braai, which is a barbecue, or Christmas. You know, it's the reverse seasons, and took off to come back to Texas. And literally was going to stay a couple days and get 6 more months on my passport and, you know, go back and get 6 more months on my passport. And I had a work visa, and that was the issue, I guess. But then I got called around that time by Rocky, who said, we're kind of starting up this film called Language of a Broken Heart, Luke, and it's kind of changed. It was originally going to be another story, and it went to this kind of romantic comedy, an indie romantic comedy that was semi-based on my co-producer, writer, who you've mentioned, Juddy Tault, and kind of poking fun of his past relationships and how he's handled them. But, you know, they originally wanted me to audition for, like, the asshole jock, you know, washed-up jock role. And I was like, hey, man, I'd love to do that, but I'd be more interested to help you on the producing side. Like, that's where, you know, I want to have more experience, and that's what I've been doing. And so anyway, I auditioned, I got that role, and they brought me on as a producer. And my big role was kind of, you know, using my Dallas connections to get locations, extras. And then I think my experience in post, I like really oversaw that side of the filmmaking process. But it was just such a great experience, because it was kind of all hands on deck type, you know, it was a 3.5 week experience making this film. And it was supposed to be taking place in Rockford, Illinois, in New York, but we, you know, shot 90% here in Dallas.
I recognize some spots. I was pointing some out to Jim Lynn, and I noticed a few spots, which makes it fun. If you're from Texas or from the Dallas area, they did a good job of simulating the different locations. But you'll pick up on Turtle Creek maybe, and like I think I saw Knox Henderson area once.
Yeah, we got on the trolley.
Yeah. So
A lot of stuff shot in the Park Cities and Holland Park, and
it's a sweet story though. I mean, it's a good the story is good. Your character is how you did not get a golden statue for being the washed up jock. I don't know, because he was such an endearing character.
Well, I appreciate that.
He had a mullet. He had it all, man.
No, I play rednecks or jocks, and yeah, I guess or washed up jocks. So you play what you know, they say. So.
But anyway, no, it's a really good film.
But yeah, so we had a great experience with that, and it was fun getting cast. You know, my friends and family, and what you can do in Texas that you can't do in Hollywood or LA is, you know, I literally got a downtown club to let us shoot there for, you know, 12 hours, and they didn't charge me one bit, you know. So it's just like that would have cost, you know, $10,000 in LA, and you know, it's just, they literally opened it up for us, and you know, people get excited about, because it's a more unique experience for people to be around a film being made.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's, and people want to help out and be part of it, be an extra. And so it was fun put a lot of my friends and family, and like my mom's in a scene, and my brothers are both in it. And like five of my best friends from high school are sprinkled throughout it. But it was such a cool experience to, you know, and I was semi-part of the fundraising, but it was more, you know, as they had most of the equity was raised, and we were just kind of off to the races. But it was really cool. That was my first, you know, big feature project. And right out of the gate, after we finished that, I was approached by this other film, Old Man Football, which you've mentioned. Which
I highly recommend. If anybody that's listening, I mean, this is the Texas Titans podcast, so let's face it, the core of our audience is in Texas. Yeah. And you know that high school football is religion. I think it even mentions that in the film. And it's a great movie, a great concept. And I'm telling you, if the 90s Sulphur Springs Wildcats and the 2000s Sulphur Springs Wildcats want to get together for charity or whatever, I'm in.
Yeah, it's basically Friday Night Lights kind of meets The Best of Times, that old 80s movie with Burt Reynolds or whatever. But it's a true documentary, that true story of these gentlemen down in Corpus Christi in the Valley area down there at the coast that lost a player that was going to go to the NFL and was murdered, and so they decided to strap on the pads, and all the cheerleaders and what were they called? The drill team came back for like a full contact game. And it was just, you know, that was the vehicle, was this scholarship fund for this young man that was taken and was like a star in the 90s. But it was the 90s versus the 2000s, which ended up becoming the beginning, kind of the genesis of what became like a South Texas alumni league. And then it ended up spreading to West Texas. From this one game, but it definitely, the whole story became a bigger deal because we were down there shooting a film about it, and everybody got more excited about it, which was fun to see. But yeah, I mean, it was I had Phil Pritchett as a Texas artist, did all my original music, and it took 6 years to finish that thing, and so it's fun that it's out there on Amazon. Both are on Amazon and iTunes. And hopefully Netflix and Hulu will be picking up it soon, Old Man Football.
Well, and let me just say something about one of the things I think that's so cool about Old Man Football. And, you know, the guys like us that played football in high school will appreciate this. I mean, the thing that makes it cool is football, unlike any other sport, mm-hmm. once you're done, you're done. I mean, like, if you're a baseball player, you can still at least go play softball, right? You can get on a softball league. Golf never ends. Tennis basically never ends. But football, and that's, it seems like most of the, because it's Texas, because it's high school football, it's more glorified, and it continues to be glorified. So there was something that struck a chord with me watching it going, I have recurring dreams that I'm back on the field, you know, because it's a do-over. Yeah. And the thing is, too, when you take adult real life frustration and all that, you long for that chance to get back on the field to one, not take it for granted and do more than you ever did. You truly take advantage. You think that's this will be the greatest game of my life if there's only one more game, because now I know what it's like to never be able to do it again. Mm-hmm. And two, just to let out the frustration to be able to hit somebody like that. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound violent or anything, but that's just, life is frustrating, and you get to go back and do that. So, I mean, I'm telling you, to the listener out there, that if you played high school football, old man football is cool. And then just the characters that aren't supposed, they're just characters because they're just Texans. They love football. And mm-hmm. I mentioned it, Mr. Young in the film that talks about, you know, it's fine to play soccer till up to about the age of six, but then, you know, that's enough.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a communist sport, so it's enough. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you couldn't.
What about Spider-Man? You like Spider-Man?
Oh, right? Yeah. Spider-Man was, literally, it's these guys that in their minds, They should be out there on Sunday,
right?
You know, and it's and one of the characters, which was the one that went to prison, what was his name? I don't know if you remember his name. It was,
we called him I'm blanking out on his name, and I should remember it, but we called him his nickname was, what's the guy from La Bamba?
Richie Valens.
Yeah, we called him La Bamba, I guess. Okay, he looks kind of like Richie Valens, kind of.
So the cool thing about his character, though, is you could tell that. For him, it really meant something deeper. He felt like he had embarrassed himself, his family, and this game was a way to kind of come back. Redemption. And he talked, it was a redemption deal. Mm-hmm. And again, folks, none of that is, it's not scripted. It's a documentary, and it's just a cool film, Luke. It really is. And,
going into that, we had so many other great characters, and it was just, that's what the struggle was of, you know, we actually premiered it originally at the Texas Theater. I had like 700 people come and got a great response, but I was still not completely happy with it. We had, I think, something like 300 hours of footage and so many other great characters, and it was just like, we had to just make choices of like who are the best storylines and how does it, like who are, you know, the most different, you know, where each person can represent kind of a different type character and right. different reason why they were, you know, the vehicle was this guy, like I said, the murder of this guy, and that they're playing for his honor and for the scholarship fund. But each person did have their own, like you said, Jason, like their own reason for like why they wanted to, whether it's to show their kids like that they're the superhero. I mean, another interesting thing was that majority of these guys were blue collar guys, probably yep. like Sulphur
yep.
would be. But
yep.
you know, I can't see this happening honestly in Highland Park, where me and the other two producers. Because you know, these guys even admitted that was literally the best time of their life.
Yeah,
you know, of being a part of that team,
right.
and now they're doing, you know, different blue collar things, and this is like a weekend warrior experience where they can go and celebrate what was a great time and kind of do a redo or a reset.
Luke, I don't want to get too philosophical here, but dude, no, that's exactly right, because there are kids that. That get to play high school football, that's it, man. That's the zenith of their life. I mean, and now you go back to Sulphur Springs, those very kids that were in the newspaper, they were celebrated, they were something important.
Superstars, yeah.
They're now working for our buddy Ryan McKenzie in a warehouse, you know, if they're working, or they're hanging out, you know, at a convenience store, you know, somewhere doing nothing.
Mechanic.
But, that's right. But there was a time where people, 5,000 people would celebrate them. And so,
and they probably had expectations that maybe they're going to go play college ball and maybe go to NFL and just kind of that dream got squashed.
And so, I mean, just, I really, the film for me, it really pulled some of that out. So, all right. So those are two big screen projects. Now, what are you doing now? What is day to day for Coffee Productions?
Yeah.
What?
So, originally Rocky wanted, my mentor kind of, we have this where we are right now. It's a great studio space in Uptown that is actually now under contract or will be soon sold. But
which I gotta say is crazy, because I mean, Uptown and the Park Cities, when I'm in Dallas, this is kind of my stopping grounds, folks. You would never know that whenever you're hanging out, like if you're around Breadwinners having breakfast, that you're literally within walking distance of a killer studio.
Yeah.
No one would ever know. It's so cool.
Yeah, I've been blessed to be part of this space, but it's a really cool, creative space, and it's been really awesome to be here. But he, you know, originally wanted to bring me on as a director for his company called Rockhouse Films, and like he had Rocky had two big clients kind of that started him here in Dallas, Southwest Airlines originally, and then he got Walmart through, you know, doing their commercials. He started directing their commercials, and his, you know, the, you know, as commercial directors, our clients are the ad agencies. So GSD&M out of Austin was his, you know, a creative director there, became a good friend and hired him for, you know, I think close to 20 years on, you know, national spots for Southwest Airlines and Walmart. And then later in the last couple of years, or the last 10 or 12 years, until recently, was doing Popeye's chicken commercials. So anyway, he encouraged me to you know, we had other films we wanted to do, and this was kind of his first film language. And I was editing, we were in the throes of post-production on Old Man Football, you know, and I had some equity raised for the post on that side, but he encouraged me to get into the commercial directing world, which there is more, you know, what you're going to make per project. But you're only really as good as your director reel. So I honestly was, you know, he offered me to come on as a director, and I was like, bro, I don't have any real commercial directing experience. I'd done some corporate videos and had done TV stuff and music videos and so forth. But I kind of, like just said, I think I need to have a turnkey company, which honestly is, I saw that as another way to, if I do it from script to screen, we do post-production where I did have a lot of experience in. I bring on an editor. I can, when I'm slow and not shooting something, we're still making money, and we're editing in the post side. So I was like, man, I think I just need to continue my little company and make, you know, just start doing whatever I can get and just, you know, building blocks, you know, that kind of got me, luckily, up to a place in the last 3 or 4 years to where we have some we have a good amount of national commercials and national clients that we've done work for, and that's just networking and showing that, you know, going and shooting spec stuff and just being, you know, being hungry and looking for opportunities. And sometimes I remember my first big commercial was like, I think I lost $300 on the whole thing. Like it was an SPCA puppy mill spot it's a beautiful spot. We won all these awards for, but like I literally did it pro bono. And I think like I had to end up paying $300 or $400, you know, out of pocket. So I was like, lost money on the deal, but it got me on the map, and yeah, it opened up other doors with this agency. And so they gave me the next job, and same thing how I got Gold's Gym. I took on like a smaller job and, you know, in hopes that I was going after the golden goose, getting Gold's Gym. So got that. And that was a great client for 3 or 4 years. And, you know, so, and just like I said, the post side has been, you know, a great way to still be generating income, you know, and keeping our company afloat while we're slower, because it's can be feast or famine. You're not guaranteed that they're not going to move on to another director, you know, for this, you know, they have different campaigns for each client, and, you know, you may get along with this cast, you know, this creative director, and then the creative director goes on to a different agency and they want to use somebody else now. So it's just kind of constantly, you're constantly doing sales and like networking and keeping, you know, you want to be promoting yourself on social media. I mean, because we are literally creating media, we have to be constantly kind of pushing stuff for social media. So that's kind of given me great experience from, you know, doing kind of more intimate projects to, you know, where it's, I love real people situations. Like one of my coolest projects was for Belk department stores, where they wanted us to go find real people in like mom and pop stores and across the deep South. And we just, you know, we went for a week and got to meet different people and just found interesting, cool people across. And I got to choose the cities they just needed a Belk store in. And we took an RV and I said, hey, I'm coming back with a full crew and we want to, you know, shoot you. And it was really celebrating these small towns and their people that go to Belk department stores. Yeah. So it was nothing really, it wasn't advertising the clothing or the products in the store. It was just really celebrating these people. So it was just such a cool experience. And like, literally we were led to like the kind of the adoptive mayor of every one of these cities. So it was just, it was crazy. You know, two different crews going, you know, 14 hours a day, you know, as we, you know, we're editing we're kind of cutting as we go in the RV, in the van, as we're going across the deep South. But it was, so that was cool. It's just each, what I love also about, you know, doing commercials is you have to become kind of an expert in each, like your client, you need to become the, you have to get to know it and become the best expert you can in a quick amount of time so you can sell their product best, their, you know, their brand.
Sure.
And so it's, you get to learn a lot quickly and get to know these folks, and it may be an ongoing relationship or maybe a one in, one out kind of thing. But it's just, it's, I like going back to the adventure of, that's what I've liked, my experience in the commercial world, because it is, you know, I'm doing one day a YMCA commercial with little kids to the next day, you know, I just posted today, I had a memory come up of Nate Newton from the Dallas Cowboys, who I got to direct, you know, who was like one of the Cowboys gods back in the 90s.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, I got to direct him in these Kim Bariatric Institute because he had lap band surgery and lost all his weight.
Yeah.
So it was just, you know, I've had these cool experiences over the years, but I am always drawn, I guess, to the real people and getting their stories, like you are, Jason, I guess, of just, you know, the acting stuff is fun and the comedic stuff is fun, but just like if you know, these Gold's Gym stories, they had the people that, you know, lost the most weight, but also their backstory is what they got them to be the Gold's, you know, champion of the year or whatever.
Yeah.
And a lot of them had these really cool emotional stories, you know, that just, you know, kind of brought, you know, reality to the audience. And it was just, you know, so that was just kind of cool. And that's, you know, that's what's, you know, those moments won't ever happen again. And so it's just kind of, I've loved that experience. But anyway.
Well, all right. So with that, this is going to be, by the way, the first ever two-part interview for the Texas Titans podcast. And I think now that
Chatty Cathy here.
No, it's perfect because now we've set up you, and it's cool because it's about telling stories. That you take, if I were to give some bullet points to the listener about the interview with Luke Coffey, it'd be one: follow your passion, follow your dreams, because life is it's a big world out there, and if you're willing to be uncomfortable, it can open up some incredible experiences for you. That even if you're having to work 90 to 100 hour weeks, you still have fun because you're pursuing a passion. For you, that passion is telling stories. And so on the other side of this, in part two, we're going to discuss probably the greatest story that you have ever told, and you are central to the story. So with that, we're going to end part one of the interview with Luke Coffey, and then we will pick up with part two. Cool?
All right.
Perfect. Hey, folks, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Texas Titans podcast. Before you go, I wanted to let you know where you can find us out there on the interwebs. You can go to show notes as well as listen to all the past episodes and look for upcoming shows at texttitans.blog. Also, that has all the different formats that you can listen to the show on if you go there. So texttitans.blog. You can also go to jasonrightnow.com. That has not only a link to the podcast, but it also has a link to my Make Your Own Rules blog that I think you'll enjoy. So please check that out. Also, it has information about my executive coaching business, speaking, and anything else like that. So jasonrightnow.com. That's literally just my name, jasonrightnow.com. On Twitter, I'm at jasonwrighttx. I would really appreciate a follow. I have not been a big Twitter user, so I need you guys to help me with that. So please take the time to go out to jasonwrighttx, find me, and follow me. I'm trying to get more active with it, and so if you'll engage with me, I'll try to do a better job of engaging with you. So I would appreciate that. And then on Instagram, I'd really appreciate a follow there. I'm at jasonrightnow. Again, my name, now. So please follow me on Instagram. And then on Facebook, I'm also at jasonwrighttx. So check us out there. I'm also on LinkedIn, so look for me there. I try to use as many platforms as possible to let you know about upcoming shows, past shows, and then also just anything that I find interesting. I'm trying to push it out and get better with the social media. So please check us out there and follow us. I would be most grateful. And also, please do not forget, it means the world to me for you to go to iTunes, give us a rating. Right now, we've got that 5-star rating. I'm hoping to hold that. Please, please, please. The comments that people are writing are so very kind. Thank you so much. It means the world to me. And that's how we keep moving up in the ranks. And right now, we're crushing it with downloads. The show has really had incredible feedback thanks to you guys. So I'm grateful. Please keep that momentum going by giving us a review on iTunes. Thanks so much and have a great day. And as always, I could not be more grateful for you listening. Thanks.